Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Patricia Spillman. Patricia Spillman has performed research on neurodegenerative diseases for more than 20 years, much of it in drug discovery. She graduated from the University of California at Berkeley and did her graduate work at San Francisco State University. She worked for more than 10 years in the laboratory of Nobel Prize winner in medicine, Stanley Prusiner, MD, and renowned neuropathologist, Stephen J. D'Armand, MD, PhD, studying prion disease. She's worked with Dale Bredesen, MD, and Varghese John, PhD, as part of the Alzheimer's Disease Drug Development Network for the past 5 years at the Buck Institute for Research on Aging in Novato, and recently also as a staff scientist at the Mary S. Easton Center for Alzheimer's Disease Research at the University of California at Los Angeles. A drug that was developed by the ADDN group is now in clinical trials with other candidates in discovery and preclinical stage. In addition to her scientific work, Patricia gives presentations to the lay public on lowering the risk of Alzheimer's disease and current and future Alzheimer's disease therapeutics. While the ADDN pursues the identification of new Alzheimer's disease therapeutics at the Buck Institute, it is their thought that the Alzheimer's disease is best currently addressed by altering overall health and lifestyle. So now, please join me in welcoming our speaker, Patricia Spillman.
Well, thank you so much, and this is a return visit for me. I was here in January, and I really like this forum and the group that comes, very knowledgeable group and a very active group. At that time, I presented a talk on nutrition and Alzheimer's disease, and I did start to touch on the subjects that I will go over in greater depth today. I really wanted to give this more time because it's about output, how you interact with the world and how it may lower your risk for Alzheimer's disease. I do want to make it really clear here, this is not a cure or treatment for existing Alzheimer's disease. There really isn't such a thing now. What I'm talking about today can perhaps enrich the life of somebody who has Alzheimer's. It may help slow disease in somebody who has mild cognitive impairment, which is the condition that precedes Alzheimer's disease. And of course, for healthy adult individuals, I hope it greatly reduces the risk of ever getting Alzheimer's disease or cognitive decline, or at least delays the onset to advanced age. I do show on my first slide here, and I hope you can see it, I don't know if they can bring the house lights down in the front, but I have the images of three brains from the top, and here on the far left is compared a normal brain and an Alzheimer's brain. And don't worry if you can't see it, take my word for it, the side that's representing having Alzheimer's on the right is quite shrunken, and the brain has lost a lot of cells due to the disease. The center frame shows the interconnections in the brain, and the far right is actually tracers that have been added to a human brain and shows how the neurons communicate with each other in the brain. It's called the connectome. It's really a beautiful image and tells you a lot about the relationships in the brain. Well, I want to go over a little bit of the background of the brain and Alzheimer's disease. I will be quick so that we can get to the real meat of the talk. But an area of the brain that's largely affected in Alzheimer's disease is the hippocampus, and it gets its name from its shape, which is like a seahorse. And as you can see, It does look a lot like a seahorse. It's really important for memory, short-term memory, in particular spatial memory. And spatial memory is how we know how to navigate in space. And so you might notice that people who get an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease might have the symptom of getting lost a lot. This doesn't always happen. It's one of the common things that we see. There are other areas of the brain. The cortex, which is the outer part of the brain, can also be affected in Alzheimer's disease. And as we learn more and more, we're finding different forms of Alzheimer's disease that affect different areas of the brain. There's a lot of different cell types in the brain. I don't want to take you to school for too long because I'm not sure how many of you have had any Red Bull before you came here. You may not be ready for this. But one of the most important cell types in the brain is the neuron. And the neuron has a cell body. I hope you can see that. It's behind my head, but take my word for it. It's got a cell body and these beautiful long processes that come off of it called dendrites, one big one called an axon, and at the end of all of those are the connections between the neurons, and those are called synapses. In Alzheimer's disease, first the synapses are lost, and then those branches start to shrink. The number of branches starts to get lower, and then finally the cell dies. There are other cells involved in Alzheimer's disease, and of course, important in the brain, astrocytes, microglia, endothelia. We don't have a lot of time to talk about them. If I find there is interest one time for having a basic talk on the anatomy of the brain and how it functions, I'd love to come back and do that. Oh, great. That was a yes. Thank you. Well, there's lots of different forms of dementia. And so often, we believe that dementia is synonymous with Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is only one type of dementia. And what distinguishes Alzheimer's disease is the presence, and this is post-mortem, meaning after death, the finding of microscopic accumulations of protein in the brain called plaques. This is not like the plaque found in coronary artery disease. These plaques are made from a small protein called A-beta. It's a fragment from a larger protein. For someone to have the correct diagnosis of Alzheimer's, they have to have the presence of these plaques. And today, finally, we have ways to image these plaques in living patients by using something called positron emission tomography. And you can write that down. We'll have a quiz on that later. I show again how the brain is very shrunken in Alzheimer's disease here. The other major pathological finding that distinguishes Alzheimer's disease is neurofibrillary tangles. Those beautiful long processes I just described in the neurons will, in Alzheimer's disease, start to wrap around each other like a crazy phone cord and pull back, and they can be seen in the brain. And just for a little biochemistry, that is a result of something called tau phosphorylation. There's a little protein called tau that, if it gets phosphorylated, will create these tangles. And so that's a biochemical finding we look for in Alzheimer's disease. This is what we do in the Bredesen lab. As I just said, those big plaques are made for something called A-beta. It's a fragment from a large protein. That large protein can be cut up in one of two different ways. In one way, it makes A-beta. And A-beta results in the loss of synapses. That is actually natural, because forgetting is natural. You don't need to remember everything you ever knew. In particular, for example, you don't need to remember where you had your keys last week or the doctor's appointment a month ago. So it's normal forgetting. But the side that we're interested in, the type of cleavage that we try to promote, is for memory formation. And in that case, a protein is formed that's called SAPP-alpha. And much of our drug discovery has been directed to identify compounds that increase SAPP-alpha. And in fact, the compound that's in clinical trials now functions by increasing SAPP-alpha. And I show that as the red balloon taking off from the cell surface. I don't know if many of you, and I hope that you have, heard some discussion of my colleague and mentor, Dr. Bredesen's work on a project called MEND, Metabolic Enhancement for Neurodegeneration. And in short, this is what it was. He treated 10 patients individually, as part of a pilot study addressing all of their health issues. He looked at all their blood work, he performed cognitive tests, and he designed an individualized program for each of them called MEND. Now, I do have to say right now, this program is not available. That was a pilot study done by Dr. Bredesen, and he's the director of research at UCLA, and he's also a professor at the Buck Institute. So he doesn't have time to see patients, but we really hope at the Buck Institute to start a program where we can provide this kind of analysis and support for people that come in as clients to address cognitive decline before it advances. Especially, we hope MEND will be great in conjunction with any drugs we develop or even with the current drugs that are available today. And very briefly, there are acetylcholinesterase inhibitors like Aricept, NMDA receptor agonists like memantine. The drugs that are available now are a good subject for another talk, and I do encourage you, if you're interested, to come see Leonard Mookie talk. I think he's going to be here in a couple of weeks, and he'll discuss current and future treatment for Alzheimer's disease, and he's absolutely preeminent in the field, so look into that talk as well. Great. Output, body, and mind. I will say now I have two talks, nutrition and AD, output, body, and mind, and the talk I'm going to give today is about output, how we socialize, intellectual challenges, exercise, stress reduction, and how it can help us with our cognitive function and in preventing Alzheimer's disease. Well, the first thing I love to talk about is exercise. And this is a special night for me because my running buddy that I've run with for almost the last 20 years is here tonight. And I point that out for a really important reason. I don't know how many of you exercise regularly, but it is much easier to do if you have a partner that wants to do it with you. You can support each other. It also combines exercise with socializing, which is excellent, and it will really keep you going longer, and I very much encourage that. I always like to show on this slide, too, some of my favorite athletes, including Russ Kiernan, who's a runner in his late 70s who lives in Mill Valley. It's him right there. There's this great publication. It might be defunct now, but I just love the name Geezer Jock. If they'll let me have the name, I'd love to take that name and maybe write a whole book on it. And and the woman seen golfing, she's the oldest golfer in England. In addition to, people always ask me exactly what exercise should I do. I'll say this, just get moving and keep moving. There is no exact dose. It's not a medication. Move every day, walk every day, dance by yourself, dance with others, especially participate in exercises that involve spatial memory, dancing, golf, tennis. The combination of moving and navigating is just superb for your brain. And I have to credit some thoughts about combining those two to a Dr. Meserich, who's an emeritus professor at UCSF, who gave a wonderful talk that I saw on using navigational memory while you exercise and how important it is. Well, one of my favorites is walking, and I really love showing this slide because I met this woman on a set of large stairs in Mill Valley. There are at least 45 staircases in Mill Valley, California, just north of the bridge, and there's a map provided by the city where you can find all of them and, of course, climb them. This combines several good things, hard exercise. One set of stairs, the Dipsy Stairs, is only over 600 stairs high, I guess is the right way to put it. So it's great exercise, but also you get to use a map and find them. And one of the things I really wanted to note here is this woman, Kelly, and she looks fantastic. She's in her mid-70s. She is out by herself. And when I encourage people to navigate to help with their spatial memory, sometimes I get questions and they say, well, when I go with my spouse or with a friend, we argue about the directions. So if you don't have somebody that you can navigate with in a positive way, I do encourage you, if you feel that it's safe, to go out on your own, take some walks on your own, and learn how to navigate on your own. And that certainly brings up the idea of all these navigation tools we have in our cars and on our phones. I certainly understand how convenient they are, and they're even important for safety, so you don't get lost. But do take the opportunity to look at a map, understand a map, and where you are in space, where the sun is, where north, south, east, and west are, and really keep navigating, and that will support that part of the brain, the hippocampus, that's important for navigation. Well, one of the great things that comes out of exercise is maintenance of bone density, and that applies to both men and women. I think everybody over 50 should have their bone density measured, and it can be addressed by exercise, particularly weightlifting, which is good for a lot of things. I do encourage weightlifting. I like everybody to leave today with the idea that if they don't already own a pair of hand weights, that they should go out and get them. That's something that is hard to do unless you're a member of a gym or you have your own weights. Strength training is super important, but it helps maintain bone density. Also have your vitamin D levels in your blood measured. Some people, even with a good diet, can have low vitamin D, even if they're out in the sun. But with age, sometimes the body just doesn't produce enough of it. And even though this is not the nutritional talk, and in that talk, I'm not really the greatest advocate of supplements. In this case, if you have low vitamin D and it can't be addressed by diet, then do consider taking a supplement and having the blood retested for vitamin D to make sure it's in the normal range. And by that, I mean the mid-range, not the low end of normal for vitamin D. Sleep is so important. Just before this talk today, I was talking to somebody who said they were having trouble sleeping. It is so common. And in fact, I saw a really interesting documentary called Sleepless in America. It's available on National Geographic, how common sleep disorders are in this country. I'll briefly say, here are some of the things that can help you address sleep issues. Don't eat within several hours of sleeping. Make sure the room is completely dark and all electronics are off. There are studies that show if we are around more golden light early in the day, it helps with alertness. But as we approach nighttime, the light should become more blue. And even for some people, actively exposing them to blue light near the time of sleep can really help with sleep. Other things, exercise helps again, encouraging sleep. If you have ongoing sleep issues, which none of these things help with, go to a sleep clinic and please have them addressed if you can. Sleep. What happens during sleep is that the brain clears out debris, and in particular, those A-beta fragments that can become the plaques. We also consolidate memory during sleep. You've probably all heard the phrase, oh, I'll sleep on it. Well, that's a real thing, because during memory, we get rid of the memories we don't know, we remember the things and solidify the ones that we do. So it's really critically important. Oh, but before I move on to sleep apnea, which is when a person stops breathing when they go to sleep, I do want to mention that some people do use sleep aids like Zolpidem, and Benadryl. Both of those drugs can be considered anticholinergic, and it's actually the cholinergic system in the brain that's impaired in Alzheimer's disease. So while the occasional use of something like Ambien is the brand name of Zolpidem, can be helpful, they should only be used rarely. The chronic use of these sleep aids can compromise cognitive function, your ability to learn, your ability to remember, and should only be used very, very sparingly. I do understand that sometimes they are necessary. So back to sleep apnea. This isn't just regular snoring. This is when somebody actually stops breathing while they're sleeping. And often people who express that they wake up several times in the night, and if you're sleeping alone and if you don't know you have sleep apnea, that might be one of the symptoms. It absolutely should be addressed, and it can be addressed by wearing something called a CPAP mask, which delivers oxygen and helps the person's brain get enough oxygen while they're sleeping. Of course, I think that it's pretty clear how oxygen deprivation would damage the brain, and it does. But interestingly, then when the person wakes up and they gasp and they take in a lot of air all at once, there's even further damage called oxidative damage because of the rush of oxygen to the brain. So it hurts the brain in two different ways. And a lot of studies have shown that there is a very close correlation between chronic sleep apnea and the later development of Alzheimer's disease. Stress is such an important one. In that MEND program that I mentioned that Dr. Bredesen created to treat patients individually, he found stress to be one of the most common factors contributing to mild cognitive impairment or impaired cognitive function in the people that he saw. Now, of course, anything you can do to relieve stress in your life is important. And I really want to distinguish short bursts of stress that it can actually be good for you. That would fall into the category of that doesn't kill you, makes you stronger. From ongoing chronic stress. It is ongoing chronic stress that can really be bad for the brain. And many studies have shown, and there's even models showing, that, for example, if an animal is under chronic stress, you can measure the levels of phosphorylated tau. That was the protein that caused the tangles, and it goes up in animals that have chronic stress. So there's a very close correlation between stress and that pathological finding in Alzheimer's disease. But say you can't do anything to alleviate the cause of stress. Please add into your life, if you can, yoga or mindful meditation. Both of these things really help handling stress. And in fact, there was a really good scientific study showing that if one takes a class on mindful meditation, about 30 minutes three times a week, and practices every day, that it preserves gray matter. And when they say gray matter, what that means is neuronal density in the brain. And they found that it was preserved in people who meditated regularly, and this had to do with stress reduction. So it's not fringe medicine. This was something that scientifically studied. And it's really a great joy in life. So it's a great way to handle stress. Another wonderful thing for the brain, and this is something that's really fun and I hope everybody does, is really keep stimulating all of your senses. Think of all of them. Of course, as we age, our eyesight tends to get worse. You know, have correction. Always keep your eyeglass prescription up to date. But also challenge your vision. Go see art. Talk about it. Use your brain while you're seeing something new. Anything that's visually stimulating or different. Novelty is so important to stimulating the senses. Very important. Have hearing checked. I think everybody over 50 should have their hearing checked about every 5 years. Get great hearing aids so you can hear the world. Listen to music, listen to the birds chirp. It's very, very important to get out there and use all of your senses so that the brain is stimulated. The sense of touch can be important. That's even petting an animal, which is one of the great benefits of having an animal, as well as stress relief. And enjoy the sense of smell as well. I had a friend of mine suggest that she should direct sensory journeys, which I just thought sounded so wonderful, to get groups of people, say, for example, to go over to the East Bay to the spice shops and smell all the spices and discuss them, or go to a tea shop and let the proprietor tell you all about the teas and really enjoy them. Really keep those aspects of sense really stimulated. One of the great things by stimulating the senses is that you might identify a loss of the sense of smell, for example, or olfaction, and that can sometimes be evidence of cognitive decline, and in particular, a higher risk for Parkinson's disease. So it might be an early warning signal that you get out of enjoying your sense of smell. Oh, I love the slide, and I just added it, and it was so great that John mentioned music. Music is so important for cognitive function. Just as he said, people can often sing the songs that they knew in their youth long after they've lost other cognitive function. And I saw a very moving documentary from Alive Inside called Music and Memory, where even in people with advanced Alzheimer's disease, if they put personalized headphones on them and they got to listen to the music of their youth, music that meant a lot to them, it's almost like they woke up again. But they did more than just respond to the music with recognizing it. They began to remember things. They remembered names. They remembered places. They started moving. It's so important. And then at the same time, I heard that Oliver Sacks, the very, very famous neurologist, has just published a book, and it will very well be his last because he's quite advanced in age now, called Musicophilia, which is really sort of a beautiful ode to the power of music throughout our life, but really how can it improve cognition. And I will say, especially for people who play instruments or conduct, they've done studies and shown that the areas of their brain that light up are very important for neurogenesis, which is the formation of new neurons in the brain, and that more areas of the brain light up with activity during the creation of music than almost any other activity. So take up an instrument, go listen to music, sing in the bathroom, sing in the car. If you're me, if you're a good singer, sing with other people, make it social. It's absolutely fantastic for the brain. This is a newly added one as well because I sought out scientific studies to prove what I thought to be true. Now, I have to say, I have to give credit to Norman Cousins, who wrote a book way back in the 70s, and I got a little hidey-ho from the back, Anatomy of an Illness, and he was very ill with a rare disease, and he decided to treat himself with comedy, which I, if I recall for him, was Marx Brothers movies, and he got better so much more quickly. Well, I looked it up on PubMed, which is the major reference service for if you're a scientist, and there's lots of study about social laughter and healing. And it has been shown that it can increase your pain threshold, meaning that if you laugh more and enjoy comedy, you can tolerate pain better. And pain is a source of stress. So that alone makes comedy a wonderful thing. But it also increases focus. After you have a great release of laughter, your body is more relaxed and you're ready to focus again. And then oddly, I found out in the course of researching this subject that looking at really cute things has the same effect. And the term they use in Japan for cute is kawaii. Now, that is not the most northern island in Hawaii, although the name sounds familiar. But in fact, they did a study where they had, and of course they were student volunteers, look at pictures of really cute kittens and puppies and then take a sort of a brief exam to see how well they did. And then for the control, they had them look at older animals or more neutral images. And indeed, if they looked at something really cute, they could focus better, which was so interesting. And even though they weren't really measuring neurotransmitters, which are the chemicals in the brain that help us, the cells communicate, they thought this was due to the release of endorphins, which help us handle pain, and stimulation of certain nerve pathways that help us relax and focus. And I really liked it because it means I have an excuse, if I get tense at work, to go on the internet and find that short video of Surprise Kitty. I don't know how many of you have seen it, but if you haven't, I do really encourage you. Well, you've probably heard this, but always try something new. Every time you learn something new, your brain has to make new cells in the process that I mentioned earlier called neurogenesis. New cells and new connections. So synaptogenesis, the formation of new synapses. Challenge yourself. Try to do something new at least every week. Maybe it's hard to do it every day, but the brain really likes it. It can be taking up art or a new kind of dance class, anything at all you can do. It has a really real effect on the brain. It's also a lot of fun. Some people really enjoy computer games. It's not for everybody, but I did see a study where, believe it or not, playing Super Mario Brothers improved cognition, even in adults. So maybe we don't like it as much when our kids do it, but it can help a little bit. And there are some great brain training softwares. I won't say their names because I'm not promoting any products today, although I think Super Mario now has to thank me. But if you enjoy computer games and you like challenging yourself, it can help with cognition. And this brings me to an idea here. I often get questions or comments after the talks where they say, well, playing a brain training game won't cure Alzheimer's disease. No, none of these things will. This is what happens if you have a good diet and you exercise and you socialize and you challenge your brain with new things and you experience music and smells and new wonders. All of these things synergistically together improve your brain. And no, it won't prevent all Alzheimer's disease, because some Alzheimer's disease has a really strong genetic component. And even if it's inevitable, it's enough, I think, for instead of cognitive decline to appear at 75, that we don't see it until 85. That's so significant. And needless to say, most of the things I've mentioned tonight improve the quality of life. And not only, for example, if you're encouraging somebody you love to do this, it improves your life as well. And that is a really important concept, that we're in this all together and we have to encourage each other to enjoy and experience all of these things. Having goals in later life equally as important. They probably go together. But of course, this means taking classes, learning how to teach, volunteering, becoming active, remaining important in your community. There's certainly studies that show that in places like Okinawa, where older people are respected and a part of community life until a very advanced age, the incidence of all disease, including cognitive decline, is lower. So that's a really key thing to do, and there's lots of ways to do it here in San Francisco if you're citizens. And so I do hope you all do that. Maintain your intergenerational relationships. I really do think one of the ideal ways to live is with older people, middle-aged people, young people, babies, all together. And so often today we get separated. Do whatever you can to interact with people of other generations. It really helps you keep on top of things. Support the health of others. Lots of studies show we are as healthy as our spouse or our buddies. Just as my friend and I run together and my husband and I eat together, we really have to support each other. So when you go away tonight, what I really hope you do is discuss all these things with somebody that you love or care about, even if you only remember a few things, and encourage them to change or add something to their life so that this message can spread out and out, starting here and rippling out, so that you can support the health of others. Every time you make a meal, every time you make a decision what to do today, it can be something that we all do together. This is a little bit more serious and is how I'm coming near to the end of the talk, and it's about the diagnosis of memory loss, and many people are interested in that. If you have, if there's somebody you love, or it's a patient you're working with or a client, shows some signs of cognitive decline, it's very, very important that it be diagnosed accurately. Now, there are really, really great memory centers at UCSF, so that's the University of California, San Francisco, and at Stanford, those are in this area, and of course at UCLA, where I work a part of the time, and there's multiple diagnostic tests that can be run. There are other health conditions that can appear to be Alzheimer's disease, like depression, multiple sclerosis, untreated infections, even brain tumors. And some of these things are treatable. So even though there are a few drugs that are effective in Alzheimer's disease, and even those drugs are only effective temporarily, these other diseases can be treated. And I had a colleague once say to me, before you're casually given the diagnosis of a disease like Alzheimer's that's untreatable and ultimately fatal, you should get the best diagnosis that you can. So I certainly encourage you to do that. Here's something I'm really excited about. I mentioned the MEND program to you. We also are working with another group at the Buck Institute to develop a cognitive therapeutics program, which it's not a computer-based, but it is sort of a training and brain challenge program for people that are experiencing some sort of cognitive decline. So ultimately, at the Buck Institute, it would be a brain health center, and where people could come in and describe, you know, how what their cognitive level is. They would be tested. Perhaps blood work would be requested from a doctor. And with all of these things together, they get nutritional counseling and be encouraged to, of course, engage in so many of the things I mentioned here today and be followed over time so that they can maintain their cognitive health as they go forward. And so that's really one of our dreams at the Buck Institute, because our mission at the Buck Institute is to increase the healthy years of life. And by doing this, I think we'll have that really a very real effect in doing that. This is just a little preview. I did do the talk on nutrition here, but I have the preview, and I know not all of you were here for that. So I just want to mention these are the things of interest. If time passes, perhaps a year from now, I could come back and do this talk again. And nutrition is a huge field, but what are antioxidants? We talk about them all the time, but often people don't know what they really are. What's the glycemic index? That involves the intake of sugar. How does intermittent fasting increase something called autophagy? There's a lot of scientific terms here, but I'll be happy to explain them if I'm invited back. How does gluten affect inflammation? And it has other ill effects now that are pretty well known. The discussion covers that as well. How much protein should you have? What is resveratrol, other than a very difficult word to say? Omega-3s, B-complexes, D3. And what's special about the Mediterranean diet? We hear about it all the time. Oh, I'll throw out another word. It's low in advanced glycation end products. We can discuss that in detail if I come back. And then finally, coconut oil, it's a source of ketones for the brain. Is that useful or isn't it? I like to present some of the controversial things, too, because it leads to discussion. All right, and that's the end of my talk this evening. I'm really happy to take questions, and I'll even stay after. I will say this. I'm going to repeat the questions back. But if it's a very personal question, it would be better to wait until after and talk to me one-on-one.
Thank you so much, Patricia. We'd like to remind our listening audience this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to Patricia Spillman, who's a senior staff scientist at the Buck Institute right here in Novato. And her program is Output, Mind and Body.
Yeah.
God bless us all. All right. We do have time for questions, and I hope you'll take some.
I'd love to. So
if a person with a question would raise their hand, we have the mic here being passed. We go.
Hi, I really enjoyed your talk and your compassion. just looking at that slide, so intermittent fasting induces autophagy, which I don't know what that is, and lower protein. I know it's good to have lower protein. Does it mean one should also have lower methionine? Is that one of the amino acids?
Oh, of course, while this is subject matter in the nutrition talk, I will cover it. Autophagy actually means to consume your own proteins. And this is how our body clears out proteins that cleared out of the body. So when we don't eat overnight, and that's what I'm talking about, intermittent fasting can be from 7 at night until 7 in the morning, so that's easy to do. Our body does clear out these debris proteins in the brain, and it induces autophagy. And that's why it's also good to not eat for a couple of hours before you go to sleep at night. It's really important to have that time. Now, it could also include a day of fasting. That's one of the more controversial things, but if for certain people, they get a lot of clarity by doing that. And then by lower protein, I mean lower protein than in the typical American diet. If your protein is already pretty low, you do not have to lower it further. And then also, if you're very active and say you are doing a lot of weight training, your protein doesn't have to be as low. It's protein itself that contains methionine, and by lowering methionine, it can have some brain benefits, but it's a matter of balance. Those were good questions.
Amino acids.
Yes.
Yes, I even wrote it down. There were reports that the increase in Alzheimer's is due to the reduction of cholesterol in the brain, which is a result of the statin-type drugs. Is there any research that supports that assertion?
Oh, so he's asking if statin drugs, those are cholesterol-lowering drugs people are given if they have high cholesterol or heart disease, can cause Alzheimer's disease. Clearly, it doesn't cause all Alzheimer's disease because only a subset of the population receives statins. I will say that statins have been shown in individuals who don't have high cholesterol, and depending on the statin, if it crosses into the brain, it can temporarily lead to memory loss. There's definitely cases reported of that, but really strong long-term studies showing that statins, if used properly in people who indeed have high cholesterol, and if the statins only bring that cholesterol down into the normal range, there are no studies showing that that increases the incidence of Alzheimer's disease, to my knowledge, but I think they're underway.
Thank you. I understood you to say do not eat 3 hours prior to going to sleep. How many hours before going to sleep should one turn off your computer?
Oh, 3 hours. No, before dinner. That's a really good question. I can't really answer that. It's interesting, though, because it does feed in a little bit to that idea of warm light versus cool light, and that's the yellow light and the blue light. But certainly, in my opinion, to get a really good night's sleep, lights should become dimmer, and you should have less stimulation coming through your eyes as you approach the time that you're going to sleep. So if I had to throw a number out, an hour and a half before you're really going to go to sleep, there's no scientific data that supports that. It's intuitive, and it's personal. As with all of these things, it has to be personalized. But indeed, keeping it on the computer until late in the night is not going to be good for sleep.
Hi, thank you. Have you heard about research being done comparing Alzheimer's, or not comparing, but referring to Alzheimer's as diabetes 3? Type 3?
Oh, she asked if Alzheimer's has been called diabetes 3. Yes, I have heard that term. And what she's talking about in diabetes, and there's two forms, insulin-dependent and non-insulin-dependent. But in both cases, the body either stops making insulin or becomes insensitive to it, even though it's being made. So ultimately, glucose is not being used properly in the brain. And so this lack of good glucose utilization can lead to cognitive decline, and that's where that is very common in Alzheimer's disease. And by the way, because coconut oil has another source of energy for the brain that can be used instead of glucose called ketones, that's why in some people coconut oil can have an effect, although that evidence is anecdotal. But I have heard that, and I do really want to point out, you know, when I see the group here at the Commonwealth Club, everybody looks very healthy and fit. But in America, obesity is an epidemic, and it is largely obesity generated from a high sugar, you know, simple carbohydrate diet. And the overconsumption of these simple sugars leads to adult onset diabetes. And so I think in the future, that will be one of the lead causes of Alzheimer's disease. That was a really good question.
Hi. My question is, how bad does it have to get for someone to actually go and have the test done? And what's the distinction between a normal memory loss and or maybe an onset of Alzheimer?
Well, I would say, well, this is what I know when it comes to memory loss. It's cognitive decline or memory loss that is very clearly a difference from previous function, and that affects everyday life. Now, having said that, I don't think I would wait that long before I went to a doctor to express this problem. But I think most people know if they're under stress for a short period of time and they're having trouble remembering things, that it's probably not a disease state, but a temporary state. But if it's ongoing and very distinguished from previous function, then certainly go in and have the cognitive tests run. And there's a whole battery of tests that they use and diagnostic procedures to diagnose mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, thanks. Are there any studies about chemotherapy? I know it's cognitive decline, chemo brain, but are you more prone to Alzheimer's if you've had chemotherapy?
That's a really it's a very interesting question, and one I've been asked quite a lot. Does chemotherapy lead to cognitive decline? I will say this: chemotherapy is almost always based on interrupting cell division, because of course, when a tumor forms, cells are dividing and multiplying unrestricted, and so chemotherapeutic drugs put that to a stop if they can. Well, that also means that neurogenesis in the brain will stop. It's very difficult, although there's a lot of progress in chemotherapy, to target it to the tumor only. So most certainly for the time of chemotherapy, neurogenesis could be impaired. And then indeed, people who are undergoing chemotherapy do have cognitive problems. I have not seen a study showing that it does then lead to later Alzheimer's, but I wouldn't be surprised if it has been done and it's true. I just haven't looked it up myself. It's a really good question.
Back to memory loss. You didn't make reference to the assumption, the common assumption that I hear all the time, that of course there is some memory loss with age. Do you think there is? And if so, how do you balance that against... Just for an example, I was at work today and I started to go through my files to put together a document and everything was looking a little familiar. And I saw another document with a title that sounded really relevant, so I opened it up and it was the one that I was creating. I mean, I did it last week and I'd forgotten all about it. I don't know if I would have done that in the past, if I should be worried, or if it's just that I'm 62.
She's asking about normal cognitive decline with age. There absolutely is normal cognitive decline with age, and it's natural. It's not something to worry about, because worry is stress, but all the things I talked about today can enhance just regular memory, even in the absence of severe decline. And so it is completely normal. It is. Yeah.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to double check with you. You mentioned it's blue light at night to avoid or to...
Oh, no. Blue light at night. Picture as the sun goes down and the yellow disappears, the light becomes more blue. It's cooler at night. Blue light is good to encourage sleep.
Oh, really? Because I had read some things about melatonin, that the blue light actually restricts your melatonin production.
Oh, I haven't read that. Yeah, I might have read a different study. You know, though, that brings up a really interesting idea about these very new studies, let's say on cool and warm light, melatonin and what stimulates it. When there's a burst of activity around a certain subject, there will be conflicting studies until it settles down a bit. And I do like to present recent studies that I find, but you may very well find something that contradicts it. So I encourage all of you to do personal study as well and to just try these things. But I like that people are looking into the effects of light and how it can help. So that's very interesting that you read something a little different.
Could you please clarify again for me? I'm concerned that radioactivity or X-rays or when you get a CAT scan or you fly a lot, for example, to Europe, it does affect your neurons, it does affect your brain. It's accumulative, all that radiation in your body naturally would affect your neurons, right? My second question is, cholesterol medication takes also in your brain the useful cholesterol your brain needs to function. So some doctors say, never take cholesterol, no matter how high it is, modify your lifestyle, and a lot of the doctors prescribe it still, and they're just in the old-fashioned treatment. So what is... what is the best solution for all of these?
So she had two questions. One, does electromagnetic radiation overexposure affect the brain? I would think that it most certainly does. I don't have at my fingertips or to my knowledge a study showing that, but it's pretty clear that electromagnetic fields affect cellular function and can increase risk for cancer. So it very well may be damaging. And so you should never have unnecessary diagnostic tests that involve radiation. That's always true. And then your second question touched again on the use of cholesterol-lowering drugs and brain function. And I am glad you brought it up again, because it lets me say that unless you have high cholesterol, your doctor should not prescribe these medications. I believe that they have shown some benefit in people, but they have to be really closely monitored. And there are certain statins that get into the brain and others that don't. But it's absolutely true that the brain uses cholesterol. So lowering it too much is not good for cognitive function. And indeed, doctors should not overprescribe statins. It should be approached with caution. And when cardiovascular disease is your personal greater risk than later dementia.
I have a genetic question for you. I have heard quite often that the pattern of Alzheimer's can possibly be father, daughter, son. Is there any truth to that pattern?
I have never heard that before. She asked if there could be a genetic pattern that's father, daughter, son. Of course, then it would have to involve the... No, that doesn't. Yeah, that doesn't make sense to me, because that goes XY, XX. Anyway, I haven't heard that. However, about the genetics of Alzheimer's disease, I don't know if some of you saw the movie or read the book Still Alice, but that was a familial form of Alzheimer's disease. That's almost always a mutation in something called presenilin, which is an enzyme that cuts that large protein that I mentioned that makes A-beta, and then the brain makes more A-beta. But there's also a genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's disease called apolipoprotein E4. And the apolipoproteins are important for lipid metabolism in the brain and protein clearance. And people who genetically express apolipoprotein 4 rather than 3 or 2 are at much greater risk for Alzheimer's disease. Now, it's a personal choice whether you get genotyped to see if you have that risk. But if you do, I can tell you a study showed that if you exercise a lot, it lowers your risk down to the level of somebody who does not have ApoE4. And so the one benefit from knowing would be that you know you really have to get out there and exercise and do all the other things that help brain function. And sorry that I couldn't answer the question.
I want to ask again a little bit about what's normal decline. When the book Grain Brain came out, almost everyone I know who pretty much lives this way that you've outlined immediately bought it, because early 60s, late 50s, and just had felt some change in the way their brain worked. And in research I've done, supposedly we're better at some things and not quite as good at others as our brain changes, and that's maybe natural and normal. But every single person had that little bit of worry, who basically are really healthy, bright people. So what's normal?
Oh,
thank you.
Well, I get to answer the question, what's normal? I can interview each of you and sort you out into groups. I can't answer that, but I think if you can keep a diary on your cognitive function and what has concerned you, discuss it with people who know you. When I say you or somebody you know, discuss it with people you know to see if they've noticed a real difference in you're really missing a lot of appointments. You're really not able to do what you used to do, or you're having a very distinct personality change. It's not always memory that changes. It can be personality. For an individual, give them a much better clue, whether it's, I can't remember that old movie star's name, right? Which perhaps isn't that serious, or I can't perform my job anymore, or I'm making a lot of errors. It is very individualized, but if you take in a lot of information and keep track of it, I think you'll know when the scale has tipped and it's time to go in for advice from a physician.
The word dementia has not come up, and of course you've referred to lessening of cognitive skills as we age. And so is that pretty much what dementia is? Because so many people, when they have, they're not sure if they have Alzheimer's, they'll say because they have dementia, they have Alzheimer's. And so as you said, it, afterlife, of course, they can determine exactly.
Yeah, I only did, she asked about the word dementia as opposed to cognitive decline. A very good question. Dementia actually is part of a general diagnosis which involves cognitive decline, personality changes. It can involve aggression or agitation, inability to make decisions or good choices. It's actually a whole variety of symptoms, and then the cause of those symptoms could be perhaps due to Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, tumors, infections. So dementia just means abnormalities in a really broad sense in how the mind functions. But it is a term that is used by neurologists. And I liked using cognitive decline because I think for the group here today, most of the people are here for what you discussed, which is changes in our ability to really use our minds well and quickly and accurately. And at least on a personal level with the people here, I don't think that they feel that they are demented or suffer from dementia, although, of course, the things I talked about would lower the risk for that as well. So that's why I use the word cognitive decline a lot. All right.
Patricia, our time is nearly gone, but I think we have time for one more question.
Yes, a few things. I read recently that if you need any light at all, it should be red. But anyway, I need to read myself to sleep, so I have a little light, but it's yellowish, whitish, further from the bed. I don't know how bad that is. Also, what is AGE? And I just wanted to say, if anyone does take statin drugs, I've read that it's important to supplement with CoQ10 because it depletes that. And CoQ10 is very important. And I also read that...
That's enough. That's three questions.
You got a three-parter there. She... Oh, that's a great one. Briefly, she asked about light again. I think I'll take the effects of light, light duration and color as something that all of you can look into. You know, I brought it up actually for the first time in this talk, and what I love about when I bring up a new subject is I get all this feedback, and I'm going to go deep into the literature and find out where they have what is called consensus, and that means when people agree on it. I have a really good feeling now that there isn't going to be a consensus much about life. However, I will say for quality sleep, turn the lights off. And that includes all the little blinking Wi-Fi lights. So that I'll stand by, but I might go soft on the other discussions of light here. And again, I will say, indeed, while it used to be that Alzheimer's could only be confirmed on autopsy, now because there is what's called PIB imaging, they can see amyloid, plaque in the brain in the living patient. It's not done, though, very regularly, so it would have to be requested, and it might be expensive. But the cognitive tests are pretty good as well, so the accuracy of diagnosis has gotten better.
Patricia, you've given us such a great program. We have a bonus question.
We have a bonus question.
Oh, thank you. It's a great presentation. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Is there actually a notion that those who actually are involved more in mental work get more of this problem than those who are actually less mentally active in terms of work habit, their work related to physical mood? Is that Is that?
Oh, that's a very interesting. Are people whose tasks in career are more their mental capabilities than physical more at risk? I will look into that. I have no knowledge about that. I see some people nodding that they have heard that. I could imagine that to a degree, if you're really not physical at all because your work keeps you seated at a desk, that means you're not moving as much. But certainly cognitive challenges are really good for the brain. And so a highly intellectually challenging job, I think, can only be good for the brain. That's a really interesting thing to look into, though, and I'll do that after this talk. Thank you for bringing it up.
You bet.
Okay. Well, let's thank Patricia Spillman for her talk here tonight. That was interesting. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.